My name is Lee Groen, and this is The Last Powderman. There's a point in everyone's life when they're deemed obsolete, antiquated by nothing more than the inevitable passage of time. Some accept this fate with quiet resignation, while others reject it, stubbornly protesting into their final days. Some, like 85-year-old retired miner Gary, just don't want to be forgotten. The phone rings several times before a deep and unfamiliar voice answers. Hello? There's annoyance in his tone, like I just interrupted something important. It's Lee, I say. His tone lightens immediately, and he drops his grumpy facade. Hold on, let me just turn the TV down. I can barely hear you. I listen as he searches for the clicker, cursing loudly against the sound of the evening news. He fumbles with the phone when he lifts it back up to his ear. Go ahead, he says, louder than necessary. Do you mind if I ask you some questions? The ones we talked about? Gary still doesn't understand why I would want to interview him, of all people, but he agrees, nonetheless. I get halfway through my first question when I hear chewing on the other end of the line. Are you eating dinner? I made spaghetti, he says, just eating while it's hot. Why don't I call you back? That would be great, he says. The second time he answers, his voice is clear, but heavy. I ask if he ever expected to live this long. No, I never thought I'd live to 80. Never, he says. Gary began his life in poverty, passed through a broken foster care system, and subsequently ended up homeless and alone on the streets of Vancouver, all before the age of 12. There, he was forced to live in the now, rarely daring to dream of anything beyond his next meal. At that age, many people wonder what they'll be like when they're older, but not Gary. I never thought about it, he says. I only thought about eating. I was always so goddamn hungry. What did you do about that? I was a survivor, he says. I survived. One morning, an old miner found Gary sleeping in the lobby of Vancouver's Balmoral Hotel. The man took Gary to his employer's office. Foggy Thompson was the name of the guy who brought me in. I didn't know it at the time, but he was a good man. A difficult life had hardened Gary, aged him beyond his years. He lied about his age, saying he was 18, and was sent just north of Vancouver to the Britannia Mines in 1952 at just 13 years old. I started hand mucking, he says, then describes clearing rock, mud, and debris from the minecart tracks, an exhausting, thankless job given to the lowest of the low. I was a hard worker. They had me drilling and blasting in 3 or 4 months. I was lucky I took to mining. I ask him how someone so young could survive like that, all alone. I mostly looked after myself, though I bunked with Buckshot Benjamin Cook for a couple of years. He didn't know why they called him Buckshot, and he never asked. Ben and his wife kept an eye on me, kept me out of trouble. You know, old Ben would sleep with one eye open. He drifts off topic, but I don't stop him. I know he'll come around eventually. I was 25 when I married Ellen in 64, and Byron was born in 69. I was working all over the country by then. His voice goes quiet. After that, I lost contact with a lot of people. How did you stay in contact with your wife and son while you were working? In those days, you went wherever the work was. I would be gone 4, 5 months, sometimes a year at a time, he says. If you were lucky, there might be a phone somewhere in camp. All the young married fellows would stand in line for hours just to talk to their families back home. And you? Did you wait with them? I didn't bother, he says. Gary would be the first to tell you that he wasn't the nicest guy in those days. By his account, he was an absent, troublemaking, chain-smoking, womanizing drunkard who picked fights at every chance he got and had a terrible mean streak that would eventually land him a stint in prison for armed robbery. How did you pass the time for 2.5 years in prison? I kept to myself, he says, and I lifted weights. But now in his 80s, 2 decades after a stroke temporarily took his ability to walk and talk and permanently altered his capacity for names and faces, it's apparent that Gary is no longer a powder keg. All that remains is an old man with a bitter taste in his mouth. Do you ever wish you had kept in better touch with anyone from your past? Sure I do, he says, but it's too late for that now. Why's that? They're all gone. Forgotten. Do you think you're one of the last old-school miners left? I think I'm the last powderman alive. Joining a dangerous industry at such a young age, Gary's mentors, co-workers, and friends have all long since passed, their names and faces slowly slipping from his mind, vanishing into the cavernous tunnels of his failing memory. They died from accidents, mining-related lung disease, cancer, or if they were lucky, old age. Most weren't. "Tell me about Vic Warren." "Vic Warren," he repeats. The name falls heavily from his lips, tumbling through the phone like loose rocks down a mine shaft. "The rock hit him in just the right spot," he says. "It was only about the size of my fist." I picture him holding his fist high, fingers gnarled and misshapen by decades of unforgiving labor, his knuckles worn flat. I can tell from his voice that he's back in that mine shaft, watching his best friend die in front of him faster than he can blink. "Safety wasn't what it is now," he finally says. There's bitterness in his voice, but acceptance too. I suggest that surely nothing is the same anymore, and he quietly agrees. The way Gary tells his stories suggests he's stuck somewhere in the distant past, still working in a mining camp up north, where he labors until he's sore and sweat-stained and can't work a minute more. I imagine him washing up and heading out to the local hole in the wall, welcoming the first sign of trouble with open arms. Yet talking to him also tells me that the miner from all these stories died a long time ago, and from his ashes a different man was born into an unfamiliar world. Technology frustrates him, and in a society dependent on it, he frustrates easily. He insists on paying with cash, and only cash, never plastic. He loves old films, the black and white sort, starring rugged men with transatlantic accents, but newer movies move too fast for him to follow. He believes the internet is just a fancier phone book, where someone can look up a name that's just come to mind, but no one has the heart to tell him he's chasing ghosts. Gary struggles to adapt to the times, but he's smart to know that if you don't, you'll be left behind, or worse, forgotten. We've been talking for nearly an hour, so I thank Gary for answering my questions and say goodnight. He tells me to take care of myself several times. I linger silently on the other end of the phone and wait for him to hang up. A couple of days later, I notice I have several missed calls from him. The phone rings half a dozen times before he finally picks up. "You tried calling me earlier," he says in place of a greeting. I tell him I didn't, but he's insistent. "This goddamn phone," he says. "I would throw it in the trash if I could." His cell phone is a relic, an ancient flip phone with buttons so big it wouldn't be unfair to mistake it for a toy phone, the sort with farm animals on speed dial. "I wouldn't blame you," I say, "but both of us know he'd never willingly sever that precious connection to the world. Listen, I had a few more questions to ask you anyway. Is that all right?" "Sure, I can do that for you, Byron," he says. This isn't the first time Gary has called me by the incorrect name. The names of his beloved but dead schnauzers, even long-lost connections. I don't bother him correcting this time when he uses his only child's name. A few questions later, Gary's off topic again. He tells me about his adventures as a young man, breaking tables arm wrestling, smuggling horses into hotels, bottling bootleg liquor, and whatever else crosses his mind. He doesn't seem to understand what the word interview means, but I don't mind. I just try to keep him talking, remembering. He describes work camps, mine shafts, and the many women he once dated. In the hanging silence between these tales, I ask, "Where were you when you got shot?" I imagine he's thumbing the scar on his forehead, the deep-set indentation still visible through his wrinkles. "Let's see," he says. The question a source of light against the wall of his memory, an oil headlamp in a mine hundreds of feet underground. "That would have been in Hudson's Hope, about 1963. He falls silent, and it's clear he's traveling back in time. "Can you tell me about it?" His voice is clear, possessed by a youthful timbre, as if a lifetime of burden had fallen from his shoulders. He finds the story, like veins of copper and gold, illuminated by reminiscence. "My grandfather doesn't hesitate. He was no good bastard, that Steinbeck. I'm sure he meant to kill me." "But he didn't," I said. But he didn't.